listeners out there, this is Deep Cover, Joe Pistone, a.k.a. Donnie Brasco and Leo Rossi, and this is a bonus episode, our first interview. Now, the interviewee is retired warden Joe Woodring. As warden and associate warden, Joe was responsible for over 1,000 staff and nearly 5,000 inmates. These included murderers, maximum security inmates, high-level drug dealers, you name it. And he also spent time, which we will get into, in Baghdad, Iraq, working for the Department of Justice and the State Department. Joe has one hell of a resume, so let's meet him. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, we got to just get something straight right now. We have Joe Woodring and Joe Pistone, right? Joe has been gracious enough, because you are our guest, that I will call him Donnie in honor of Donnie Brasco, and I will call you Joe. So that makes it nice and easy, right? So where did you start? Where were you born? What part of the country?
Okay, I was born in a real small town in Pennsylvania called Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. It's a little college town. And I ended up going to college at Penn State. I'm a Penn State graduate. Once I finished college, I started at a place, a non-federal place, a place called the Devereux Foundation in Philadelphia, and got my butt beat there, physically got my butt beat there. I did that for about 10 months, and my sister was in the feds at the same time. She was at Allenwood Federal Prison Camp, and she was a case manager. And she said, you know, you should come to the feds. It's a lot safer. They pay well. They have a retirement system. They have health insurance, blah, blah, blah. I didn't even know what retirement meant back in those days. So I applied with the feds, and I started at the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary. I was 24 years old.
Hello.
Hello. Reality. Reality.
Joe, before you go any further, can I jump in here?
Sure.
What made you get into the correctional system? And the reason I ask you that is that, like, I always knew I wanted to be a cop, okay? I never thought about corrections. I got a lot of friends that are retired New York City cops and a couple that are retired U.S. Customs. They started as correctional officers in New York State, but they were waiting to get into the PD or U.S. Customs, and, you know, while they were in the correctional profession. So basically, my question is, why corrections?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, one thing for sure is, if you're in high school and you're a guidance counselor and a kid comes into you and the guidance counselor asks that kid, hey, what's your career objective? If that kid says, I want to be a correctional officer, if I'm the guidance counselor, I'm going to send him down to the hall to the psychologist, okay? Because it makes no sense. The reason I got in was I wasn't making any money. I only had a SOCH degree. I had a BA in SOCH. I wasn't making any money working for the Devereux Foundation. And that's the other thing my sister sold me on, said they pay well. So I thought, let me give it a shot. Let me give it a shot. And she said, it's going to be safer. You know, it's going to be safer work. So I put in and it was interviewed. And then I started and started at Lewisburg Penitentiary. And for those of you that don't know about the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary, part of that place, it was built in 1932. And it's surrounded by a 60-foot solid cement wall. It's got 8 guard towers on it, all armed. And when you walk into that place and the door slams behind you the first time, you know you're in the big leagues. And I was 150 pounds soaking wet back in those days. I'm about 6 foot tall. And I was the lightest correctional officer that they had. Out of 180 correctional officers, I was the lightest one. So very, very intimidated by the environment. And, you know, that's, I can stop there. I can talk more than you could talk. So you shut me off, Joe.
I know Leo for 22 years. Nobody could talk more to him. Let me ask you one more thing. Did you have to go to an academy or school, or, and how long was that? And what did they teach you?
Yeah, I did. It's at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe.
In Fletsy,
yeah, Southern Georgia, in Brunswick. It's a 3-week course. And you learn, you know, personal defense, you learn rules and regulations, how to defend yourself, how to shoot a weapon. You're in there with a bunch of other people in the academy. You learn diversity, affirmative action, equal opportunity, employment, things like that. So it's a very thorough training that you go through. And, you know, you go through a mock hostage situation where you're taken hostage. Mm-hmm. And even though it's mock, that's enlightening.
Yeah, it comes out real.
Yeah, it really does. So, but it was great training. I'd never been through any training like that. They, you know, they really, I came out of there a whole lot smarter than I went in.
Now, do you have retraining throughout your career?
You do. You have annual refresher training, and it's mm-hmm. usually every January, and you qualify again with firearms, and you just go over rules and regulations and, you know, anything updated, anything new. So it's the feds are really good about training. That's the one thing I can always say about them. And during the course of the year, you'll have special training sessions. And I had a variety as I went through my career. And I'll mention one that was spectacular was the media relations training or public information officer training. That proved to be invaluable to me later on down the road. But it was training like that they would go to, they would send you to, and it was extremely good stuff.
How were you lucky enough to get signed to Lewisburg in the first shot out of the box? Well,
you know, there's one thing that you said about Lewisburg. I wrote the John Gotti Jr. story, right? And when he was a kid, he went to visit his father in Lewisburg, and all he talked about were those walls. Can you imagine a kid 7, 8, 10 years old going in and seeing those walls? He said it didn't deter him, unfortunately, but he said it was ominous.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And what happens within those walls is pretty bad because it's all predators. Every single person that goes to Lewisburg is a predator.
Yeah. Joe had in one of our episodes, Joe started out with, all wise guys are bad men. And he, you know, depicted a lot of reasons why. Oh, yeah, they may treat their mother and their grandmothers and all that stuff great, but kids, yeah. But still, man, I mean, there are predators.
Yeah.
Bad men.
Yeah.
Wow.
How long did it take you before you became a warden, Joe?
Oh,
I mean,
is that
a process that you go through training or other courses?
It's a progression of positions of increasing responsibility. And they put you through a lot of personality testing, official personality testing, because they want to know who they're putting in the driver's seat. They're not guessing on that. So before I was warden at two institutions, I was associate warden at two others. So it's a progressive thing. And before I was associate warden at the other two places, I was an executive assistant to the warden, which means you basically sit at the right hand of the warden and you go over, you know, decisions and why he would let you know why he's making this decision. And, you know, some of them are controversial. Some of them go against the grain of what maybe the rest of his staff are thinking. But, so you're really at a great level there to see what's going on. And that left a big impact with me as far as how to manage inmates, how to manage your staff. So, good stuff.
So every facility has a warden and an assistant warden. So there's two people in charge basically at the top.
Yeah, it depends on the size of the facility or what the mission of that facility is, because you have prison camps, which have a warden and an associate warden. And then you jump up to low security, where you have a warden and two associate wardens, usually. And then as you go to a medium and a high level, high maximum security, you may have three associate wardens. So, and then what they do within those associate wardens, they'll rotate their responsibilities around like every year, so they get the broad spectrum. Because you have an associate warden of operations, you have an associate warden of programming, and you have an associate warden usually either over security, specifically over security, or one over what's called Unicor, which is Federal Prison Industries, which is not the same now as it was when I started.
Now, this question, I don't know if you're allowed to answer or reveal it, but the major facilities, do they have, maybe they don't call them SWAT teams, but do they have a SWAT team type squad assigned to the prison?
Yeah, most facilities at low security and above have what's called a SORT team, Special Operations Response Team. And you pick, you know, you handpick those guys, and they're some big linebacker looking dudes.
And I was told they're the biggest guys on the job. Right?
They're big and they're well trained, and they just get every once in a while, they just get a day or two off, like about, I think twice a month, just to do nothing but pump iron for the whole day. I mean, they work out anyway on their own, but they're marksmen. They'll kick your butt. They're good. And, you call them in if you have a riot. They assemble when there's a riot. Now they're taken from your regular, workforce. These guys are
the regular, officers.
Yeah, the regular correctional officers. So, some of them are right there when the crap hits the fan. They're right there ready. And then we summon the other ones to come in and back them up. And like I said, they'll respond to riots, to, what's called a forced cell move that went bad. And, you know, I've never seen a SORT team, or I've never been in an institution where a SORT team has let me down, ever. So they're
that's wow. great to
yeah,
hear.
They're that good. Yeah.
Well, now, Donnie. This is for Donnie. When you were at Quantico, didn't you have a team, the hostage response team, that they just
HRT,
stayed in shape and lifted
wrestling.
Weights? Yeah.
That's all they do all day. They don't investigate anything. They stay at Quantico. They work out and they do scenarios, real life scenarios, you know, rescue missions. And these guys, the Husker Rescue Team, they train with the Navy SEALs. They train with the Rangers, Marine Recon. They train with all the military special forces teams. But that's all they do is they're based at Quantico and they just work out and train.
Now, Joe, you went to Penn State and you probably had friends that were on the football team. At your weight, you probably weren't on the football
team. No, I wasn't.
No, I assumed
that. I didn't qualify for water boy.
But so you get into Joe Paterno, great coach, unfortunate ending, but great coach. And he was a motivator. How do you motivate your staff in prison?
Well, you know, you motivate by example. I didn't manage from my desk. I managed from the compound. So I would go out, and you're in a suit and tie as a warden. I mean, that's just bureau code. You have to do that. I would go out. I would go in housing units, just walking around doing my rounds. And I would start doing a shakedown myself. I'd shake down a guy's locker. I'd pat search a guy. I would check under his mattresses. I'd tear his bed apart. So your staff usually don't expect the warden to do that. That's their job. But I wanted to lead by example. So if I do it, then as a correctional officer, you better be doing it. And that revved people up. That got them excited about doing their job. And plus, I didn't take a bunch of baloney from inmates. I didn't take it from my staff. And your staff know who the bad staff are. And I didn't take that nonsense. I dealt with it pretty quickly. And your staff get charged up about that. They respect the heck out of you for doing that.
I would think you probably gain respect from a lot of the inmates by being hands-on.
You do. You're out there available for them, because one of the misnomers of prison and jail is that they're locked up all day. Well, not my guys. And not even in a maximum security. Most of the maximum securities, these guys are walking around. You're shoulder to shoulder with them all day. In most people wear what's called a body alarm or carry a radio or both. I didn't carry either of those when I walked around. And I'm not a tough guy. If you guys had seen me in person, you'd say, man, oh man, this guy, there's no way he's a tough guy. But I carried myself with confidence because I knew nobody was going to hurt me on that compound, because I had enough other inmates that, like you said, respected me and had my back.
You talked about the motivation factor by example. So your motto is don't sit behind a desk, right?
Absolutely.
Was there a normal, Is there a normal work week for a warden or a you know, what do you do day in, day out? Do you have a curriculum that you set up or is it down on paper?
It's not down on paper. My typical day, I got at the institutions very early. I didn't put in 8-hour days. My days were probably on average about 10-hour days. But I would go in, sometimes I get up on the weekend, I'd just go in on a Saturday, just try to keep people on their toes, do the same on a Sunday. I'd crawl in there on a Thanksgiving day when they thought I was, you know, taking the day off. What I do on a typical day is I go in, check my emails, and then I hit the compound. And I hit the compound for about 4 hours, almost all morning. I'm on the compound, just walking around, going through housing units, going through work areas, going through the education building. And again, mingling and talking to the inmates. That's how you get information and relationships. You're building relationships. And I go through segregation every day. You're not required to go in every day as a warden. You're supposed to go in once a week. I went in every day. And again, you're building credibility with guys. And guys would ask you, hey, will you let me out? You know, can we do this? Can we do that? And that's a story that we'll need to address, Leo, is how I kept guys in segregation. But that was my typical day. And then you deal with emergencies as they come up. You might have a fight on your compound. You might have a sticking somewhere. And you're out there in the compound and you just kind of make sure you get over there too. And you're witness, you know, first responder to that.
Is there an officer always with you?
Never. I didn't want guys to congregate around me because I got better information when I didn't have people around me.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a way to, you have to interrogate these particular type of individuals, the predatory type.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, there is an interrogation. I mean, I need to have a reason first. What I normally do in a normal day, this is what got me information, is I didn't treat them like inmates. I treated them like they're human beings. And they often complimented me on that. Said, warden, you don't treat me like other wardens. You know, you talk to me like I'm a human being. And that's what I did. You treat them with respect and you get it back. So I didn't have to do interrogations on inmates. I really didn't have, well, I did get involved a few times. Because part of my background was investigations. So I did it a few times. It's fun. But I can play softball or I can play hardball, you know, but I usually got my information.
And hardball would be what?
Would be you cut into their space, you get into their personal space, you raise your voice, and you say, you know, I can transfer you. Not locally. I can transfer you across the country. That's a major thing with inmates because a lot of them, you know, Bureau of Prisons.
Put them on that midnight train.
Yeah. Yeah. We call it diesel therapy.
Yeah.
But a lot of them, you know, their family lives right near the institution. So if I transfer you, let's say you're in Terminal Island, California. If I get you transferred to Raybrook, New York, you just lost all your visits. So it's, That's a wake-up call for a lot of them, because that's the worst thing about prison is that you lose your family. So, but you get these visits, they matter a lot. But if I take that from you, you know, what do you have left? It's good leverage.
Talking about Terminal Island, what mob guys, what Italian mafia guys?
I was afraid
you're
going to ask me that. I didn't have a lot of mob guys at Terminal Island, but you're probably going to know the names that I tell you. You're going to know Rosario Gambino, and I've known Rosario a long time, and you're going to know Donnie Montemurano.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes,
Shax,
sir.
Donnie Shax. I know these guys very well, and I'll tell you a real quick story, and I should have started out making him anonymous. But I had Donnie at MDCLA first, the jail. That's where I met him.
Uh-huh.
And if you Google Donnie Montemurano, he's a very interesting guy. He was in the Colombo crime family. He went down with Carmine Persico. And, you know, Persico was, that was big time.
Yeah.
Persico died.
I know Carmine.
Yeah, he died last year, March 7th of last year.
Yeah.
And, Donnie, I met him in the jail, in the federal jail. And after, after the jail, I did a bit up in central office in DC for 2 years. And I came back to, you know, eventually circled back to Terminal Island, and there's Donnie coming up to me in the compound. Hey, Gordon, how you doing? You know? And Gambino's with him. And I had met Gambino in the 80s in Terminal Island when I was there as a squirt. So Donnie was always charming. So was Gambino. These guys knew how to do time. The mob guys knew how to do time. I'd take a whole institution full of them. They knew how to do time better than any other white guys. A lot of white guys are crybabies. The mobsters aren't so much crybabies. Every once in a while, Donnie would cry once in a while. Not literally, but figuratively.
Well, just what you said, John Gotti Jr., I had been with him 2.5 months, you know, working on the script. And he looked at me and said, you know what? You could do time. I go, what the hell? What does that mean? You just explained it.
Yeah.
That was a compliment.
Yeah, yeah. I was hoping maybe Joe would come out of retirement and do a gig undercover in prison. I'd love that, man. I'd love to read the book. So, one other guy that I had, and this was, I was at Fort Worth Medical Prison. And we had a geriatric unit there, and I got Gigante. Remember Gigante, the guy that used to walk the streets of Brooklyn in a house coat and bedroom slippers?
Did you put him in jail?
I had him, and he, you know, on the streets he always acted crazy, and that was, you know, that's part of his guise. But when I got him at Fort Worth, he couldn't have been a nicer gentleman and bright eyed. And he's another guy. He just died, I think, 2 years ago.
Yeah,
the chin.
The chin, the chin Gigante. Yeah, yeah. Yep, that's who it was.
You never crossed Bill Bonanno when he was out there, huh? That wasn't during your time?
I didn't have Bill Bonanno. You know, a lot of the guys, I forget their names. There were so many at Lewisburg, but it was so long ago. They lived basically down on what's called J Block. That's where they put all the mobsters. Because, again, they knew how to do time. And J Block was a dormitory unit, not a cell unit. And they put the really assaultive guys on what we call a cell side, and then the not so assaultive guys on dorm side. And that's where the
how did the mob guys get along with the other gang inmates?
They were really good. I know Gambino and Montemurano stayed out of the nonsense, but in prison, if you have a common interest, you tend to bond with whatever group you need to bond with to get something done. I mean, I've seen rival factions of the Mexican gangs get together. I've seen some of the mobsters work with some of the black gangs, you know. And Donnie and Gambino used to talk frequently with a lot of the black guys. I don't know what they were covering, but I knew they were up to something. But I had the Crips and the Bloods leadership in Terminal Island too,
and in the federal prison system in the state of California, because you had done it you were warden at two different locations. What we hear, what we read, and one thing that Joe, you have in common with Donnie is the way the movies and TV present the prisons and the life of crime. Because he says, if you ever watch a show, he goes, look at that. Look at that bullshit. That's bullshit. It's like this. And I have a feeling you feel the same way.
You know, every night on the newscast, you know, they're going to talk about somebody going to jail or somebody going to prison. And you see the door slam. That's such a cliche, you know, because the door doesn't slam, but maybe twice a day in a prison, you know, the way they're using it. But no, they depict prison as, you know, the end of the world and blah, 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 blah. When I was at Terminal Island, I used to give tours to a lot of college classes, members of the public that showed an interest. I'd take them through my joint. I took my wife. I took three of my friends. I took all four of them through at one time and let them see. Now, everybody's scared because they realize these guys aren't locked down. So that's one of the big misnomers that you see in movies. They're starting to get better. they're getting a lot better about what prison it looks like. But yeah, it's just some of it, you know, I'm just like, oh, come on. This is such bull. This is embarrassing. There was one not too long ago. I forget which one it was, but I said, I had to turn it off. I said, this is just embarrassing. Yeah.
Well, that's like, I don't watch any cop shows that for that reason.
Yeah, nothing.
You have a kindred spirit here. Joe and Donnie.
Oh,
how beautiful.
I'm telling you.
Deep Cover will be right back after this short message. And we're back with Deep Cover.
Now, there was, years ago, I remember seeing, it was a documentary, and it was called Scared Straight. I believe it was at the Rahway State Prison, right? And they used kids that were at risk, you know, to really have a life of crime, and they let the inmates run that. Now, that's all got to be choreographed, correct?
Right. Yes. Yes. We used to do a panel discussion. We didn't threaten and intimidate, try to scare the kids. We'd bring the kids in, and then I'd have a panel of inmates sitting up there, and they would talk about their individual crimes, how they ended up in prison, what their thinking was. And then they'd allow the kids to ask them questions. And it worked out real well. And the one notable thing, we had about five guys in the panel, and one of them was a biker. And the one kid, this kid couldn't have been more than 14, 15 years old. And he asked the question of the biker. He says, did you ever kill anyone? And he goes, no, I beat the rap. He says, but did you kill anyone? He says,
that's his mindset.
I beat the rap. So you kind of know what was going on there.
Yeah. I don't know if they still do it, but when I was at Quantico in 92, 93, 94, and part of 95, they used to take the new agents through the facilities in D.C., you know, because ones that weren't police officers or in the military, you know, they probably had never been inside of a jail, and they used to take them through and, you know, give them the spiel, which I thought was pretty, you know, was a pretty good idea.
They probably took them into the D.C. jail. That's a circus in there. I've never been in, but I've heard plenty of stories about it and talked to inmates that were in it. And I don't need to see that.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a lot different being in a federal lockup and being in a local lockup.
Oh, yeah, big time.
You're right. The local lockup is I know a lot of guys, you know, when I was on the job, would say, please make sure you get me into the federal system.
Yes. No, you're
absolutely
right.
I didn't want to go into the state system.
Yeah.
Not one bit.
Yeah. I've been in state joints and been in the feds. I'll tell you where else I've been, which we didn't talk about. I don't know if we talked about it on my resume or anything, but I spent 9 years in private prisons doing private prison work. And I've been in and out of those private prisons. And that's a whole different ballgame. They smell different. Yeah. They smell different than a federal joint.
What is a private prison? You're saying state? Is that what private is?
Or? No. Private prisons. I was with a company that, it's the biggest private prison provider in the world. And what you do is in private prisons, you have several options. You can build a new one. You can build your own prison. You can go in and renovate a prison and take that over and run it. What was the other option? I can't think off the head. But we also did state hospitals. So you could go in and take those over. But you can build them. You can take them over and run them yourself.
It's a corporation, Leo.
It is a corporation. Yeah. And your staff, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but your staff are not as sharp as your federal staff. Your federal staff are very sharp. And in private prisons, they pay less, and they don't have a retirement plan.
That's why the states and, you know, want them.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a private prison is a whole different ballgame.
Just as a lighter note here, maybe you can help me. Joe, you were born Donnie. You were born where, Donnie?
Robertsdale, Pennsylvania.
Okay. I was born in Trenton, New Jersey, but raised in Northeast Philadelphia.
Wow.
Okay. So, and I went to Villanova, and the one thing that amazed me, not Bloomsburg, but you had state schools called California State Teachers, yeah. Indiana State Teachers. What the hell is that about? I mean, these are all, it's interesting, but really, those state teacher schools in Pennsylvania are very good.
They are.
Yeah. They're held to a higher standard. My first wife, she went to Slippery Rock State Teachers
sure,
College.
Sure.
Right. And I would send letters for her to Villanova back in the letter day, and I would address it Slimy Pebble State Teachers College. And she got it.
Oh my gosh.
She would get the letters.
Oh
somebody
gosh.
In the post office had a they had a sense of humor, for God's sakes.
You Joe, know. tell us about your time overseas. I know I've done a lot of work over in countries, friendly and unfriendly countries.
Yeah.
And
well, that was that's another one where you got to say to yourself, why would you do that? And about
yeah, uh-huh. I said that plenty of times.
I was retirement eligible. This is in 2009. I had just become retirement eligible. And I think the Bureau knew, you know, I wasn't interested in probably being a warden for the third time. I got it. I got it the second time. So on, they wanted me to go to MCC New York as a warden. They were really Ooh. Pushing at me to do that. And I finally said, all right, I relented. And they said, well, get your senior executive service paperwork into justice, main justice. So I get a call, and they said, hey, you know, we've approved your SES. So my regional director is saying, okay, when you're ready to go, he said, I think you'll be going to the next executive staff meeting. You know, so I'm like thinking, man, I really don't want to go to New York. It's too cold. I get a call on, I believe it was October 16th, and this guy introduces himself and, he says, I'm calling you from Maine Justice. And we're talking a little bit. I'm just listening. And we're into this conversation. I'm asking very little. My input is just very little. And about 15 minutes into it, he says, I'm talking about going to Iraq. Would you be interested in going to Iraq? And this is what we'll do for you. And, you know, and he starts talking about this, and he says, about 20 minutes into it, he says, do you have any questions? I go, I just got one question. How much are you going to pay me to do this? And he says, well, we give you 70% for this and, you know, 20% for this. We give you better. So I got my calculator, and I'm a money guy. So I said, so if I understand you right, you're going to pay me this amount to go to Iraq. He says, yes, we are. I said, I'm going. That's why I went to Iraq. Again, I'm not a tough guy. So when you get there, the worst part of Iraq to me was getting there, because you have to go through so many changes on transportation, and you don't know where you're going at some point. You know, at a couple of points, you don't know where you're going. So while I was there, and I'll cut this short, I stayed at the embassy, and the embassy has a wall around it and has guards walking around the top of the wall. And to get into the joint, to get into the embassy, you have to go through what's called a sally port. I don't know if you guys are familiar with what a sally port is.
Yeah.
But,
No, I'm not.
A sally port is they open up a sliding door, and you go into that compartment, whatever that compartment is. That sliding door then slides behind you. Now you got doors on both sides of you.
You got claustrophobia.
Yeah. Then they open up this door to go. So you have always have containment. It's we call them sally ports. So the embassy has the wall, the guards, and sally port entrances. And there's all kind of security. And I had security with me and a translator with me almost at all times. So you went from running a prison to basically being in a prison. And psychologically, that really messes with your head. It really messed with my head. But while I was there, right across the street was the courthouse where Saddam Hussein stayed. So I went into Saddam Hussein's old cell. I went into the courtroom where he was found guilty. And then I went out to a prison called Qadamiyah. And in Qadamiyah, I went into the execution room, stood on the gallows that hung him, touched the rope that hung him. So I got to be, you know, intimately involved in Saddam Hussein, you know, this is again, I think he had perished maybe 5-6 years before I got there, but they still had the rope there. But, you go into prisons in Iraq that have dirt floors. What we were teaching the Iraqi correctional officers was basic human rights standards. 3 meals a day, access to hot and cold water, access to a bed. And the funny thing about the Iraqis, they didn't want a bed. They wanted to sleep on the floor.
They liked the mats.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It was really interesting. I was over there for 9 months. And then that's when I retired from the feds and went into private corrections. They made me a good offer. But it's one of those things where looking back, if somebody asked me now, hey, we'll pay you, an exorbitant amount of money to go back to Iraq, I'd say, no, thanks. I'm glad I did it, but I wouldn't do it again. It's one of those things in life.
Yeah, you and Donnie there, it's, what's the line from the Tom Cruise movie? Show me the money. No, but I mean, if you're going to risk your life like that,
right?
You have to be compensated.
Yes.
I mean,
absolutely.
For God's sake. That's the red zone. Is that what they call
it? Yeah, I lived in the green zone and worked in the red zone.
Yeah.
And when you hit that red zone for the first time, the pucker factor goes way up.
Oh boy!
I was in a country and they were showing me around the. It was a training facility, so they're showing me around and we're down in the basement and in this big room, and I see all these nicks in a wall. Now I shot enough ammo to know that they're ammo. That's a bullet nick. he said, oh yeah, this is where they used to assassinate all the political prisoners.
Oh, yeah.
When we got them.
Well, we trained the Iraqis. I hate to say this. We trained the Iraqis how to do executions, how to hang somebody. So we taught them how to build a gallows, because what they used to do, and I saw what they used to do, you walk into a dirt floored room and there's a cement shelf, and they used to stand the guy up on the shelf, wrap the rope around his neck, and then push him off the shelf. And hopefully he wasn't a tall guy and his feet drug on the ground, because then they have to jump on him and go like up and down to do the execution. So.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got a little graphic there.
No. Joe loves graphic. Donnie does graphic. I'm going to go nuts here. Two Joes. Now, you did say in some of the resume that one of your valued friends was razor wire.
Oh man, I didn't know I put that in my resume. I loved razor wire. I absolutely loved it. And every joint that I went into, I said, if there's a flat spot, you put razor wire on it. And people are like, holy cow. And I solicited central office headquarters to allow me to have a razor wire factory. And they wouldn't let me do it. They knew I was just crazy.
You're a good warning, Joe.
one thing that I never asked Donnie, and I'll ask you, did you ever have an undercover, deep cover agent, either federal or state, planted in the prison to try to get information out of another prisoner? Anything like that?
No, the feds, the Bureau is not big on that at all. We've been asked over and over again. And when I'm asked, I don't have that authority. I got to go to Washington. And Washington never allowed that, to my knowledge.
My ex-partner, Steve, he did a few weeks in the joint. And they put him in with a guy that had killed a cop. The only person that knew he was in there actually was the warden. The officers didn't know, you know, who he was. The guy finally opened up to him, you know, the jailhouse conversation. And the guy admitted to Steve, he thought Steve was another hitman. But I don't know that I'd want to do 2 weeks in the joint. I mean, the times I went in there locking people up, and it was enough. Yeah.
See, that was one thing that amazed me with Joe, with Donnie, when he was down in Florida and they were setting up a casino. He, plus Sonny Black and Lefty and all, they got arrested and they got taken in. And I went, Joe, the masquerade's over. You're dead, right? What? Yeah, but what
that's
happened,
a local.
Joe?
Well, that's a local. You know, I mean, you're thrown in the local cell, you know, and your lawyer gets you out the next day or something. But to be locked up and go through the regular routine, that's tough, man. I don't know. That's tough. I mean, Steve did it for, I think, 2 weeks. He was an inmate. And like I say, the only person that knew was the warden.
What joint was it, Joe? Do you know?
It was in down south. I don't remember what state, but it was a state prison.
Oh, state.
It wasn't,
okay.
It wasn't a
okay.
Yeah. It wasn't a federal prison. Okay. Yeah.
You know, the this has been fascinating for a lot of reasons. On our show, Joe talks about on the outside in crime, and he lived it, and he lived it for a lot of years. And then he went, you know, and he went to Siberia, Haiti, London, still undercover, you know. But the prison side of it, very fascinating, because the one thing Gotti told me was the BOP, it's another society. He said, it's everything is different. He said, it's different. And I can see why, man. You got competing groups. I mean, okay, you got the Mexican organization, right? You got the Aryan Brothers. Do you have to align yourself with a group for your safety if you're an inmate?
Oh, if you're an inmate, yeah, you don't have any choice. I mean, you just have to. And when you go into a dining hall, you'll see that alignment. It's right there in front of you. And the leadership of the whites and Blacks and the Mexicans will get together and say, okay, this is your table and we'll take this table. So it's just perfect. It's perfect. The separation.
Joe, let me ask you this question. So a guy's just a gangster. And when I'm saying a gangster, you know, a thief, a whatever, yeah. He's not affiliated with anybody. He goes into the joint. How does he align himself?
Yeah, he's got to find somebody very quickly, and usually that's going to come through, you know, like you normally would meet people. It's going to be in your housing unit. You're going to bump into somebody pretty quick because the inmates are going to approach the new guy. Hey man, what are you in here for? You know, and where are you from? They're going to do that stuff. So, you're going to get alliances, you're going to get buddies and all that stuff very quickly. And you know, you could do it on the rec yard, you know, while you're lifting weights, you could meet them there while you're walking the track, you know, mm-hmm. but that's how it is.
Now, according to what your criminal specialty is, lack of a better term, you get respect from that way. So suppose you're in for murder. You get more respect than, you know, somebody that's, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it kind of depends on who you murdered. And you know, I hate to say it like that, but, if you whacked a female, that's not going to go over big at all.
Yeah, I would guess, yeah.
That's not going to go over big at all.
Now, what about sexual predators?
Oh, not good. Not good. That was one of the problems that I had at Terminal Island. When I got there, we were loaded with child molesters, and that is that's your hardest group to protect, and because they're getting smacked around and extorted all the time. So when I got there, and then we had transgenders too. And that was
they put them in population.
Yeah, Yeah. The way the...
is it you have to?
Yeah, you try to, because segregation is costly. It's expensive to run a segregation unit. But yeah, so we call them the child molesters, we call them chomos. So the chomos, you generally are going to have to lock them up. You're just going to have to. Because with communications the way they are today and information with the internet, there's not secrets for very long, even in prison. So yeah, that's a hard population to manage. The transgenders tend to get, it's pretty hard because they're into prostitution. And
was there ever a prison that you were working at, either from the warden or down to associate warden, where there was someone executed, by the state, by the federal government?
No. The only executions in the feds are come out of Terre Haute, Indiana.
Yeah, and I was in that prison.
You were there? Yeah, that's...
Yeah, I had a witness guy that I used to go see there.
Oh, yeah. Terre Haute is Lewisburg without the wall. It's the same construction, same time frame. But no, I never had anybody executed that I was... Because I didn't work at Terre Haute. So, I had plenty of guys with a life sentence, plenty of them.
Boy,
that's a grim future. I mean, when someone gives up hope, I would imagine that they can just run amok every which way they want.
That's it.
Well, our next guest, because you're the first guest, they got a long way to go up that hill to do what you're doing. Fascinating, Joe. Really. And thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And I'll come back anytime. You call me anytime, Leo.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Deep Cover, The Real Donnie Brasco. And what else, Leo?
Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Jam Street Media.